Previously on Beta.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm Brophy. I work at the Institute. I came to pick you up. I'm going to be your driver and sidekick.
Oh, how do you do?
Hey.
Hey. Where's Frankie?
You tell me. I'm looking for him.
You ain't alone. Lay down a bet on the Knickerbockers over in Milwaukee.
They get the Bucks one.
A week ago. From Triple OT. Very dramatic.
You see Frankie, you tell him I'm looking for him.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our show. We had a lot of fun yesterday, a different kind of fun today. No pies.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. 74-time Jeopardy! Champion Ken Jennings explains how we ended up living in an all-comedy, all-the-time world.
I'm not against this new woker audience, honestly. I think it's great that instead of giving comedians a pass and being like, well, he said something awful, but he's a comedian. I like the idea that we're actually able to grapple with these things now and say, well, hold on, what are the effects of that joke?
Also, have you ever used a spreadsheet to rate your dates? Courtney Hameister has.
But it's not until someone that you truly care about is on the spreadsheet and you're looking at the numbers that you assigned to him when you first met him that you really feel like a jerk.
The former radio host and writer joins us to talk about her year-long experiment to fight OCD and anxiety. George Pelicanos is keeping busy these days. He's the co-creator and writer of the HBO series, The Deuce. The show finds him working with David Simon again. George and David have worked on a couple of other shows you're probably familiar with, The Wire and Tremé. Besides working in television, George still finds time to write best-selling crime novels, 20 so far. His latest is called The Man Who Came Uptown. The book's main character discovers a love for reading while in prison, which strongly resembles this scene from The Wire.
All them books in his library. Now, he fronting with all them books. But if we pull one down off the shelf, ain't none of the pages ever been opened. He got all them books, and he ain't read near one of them. Gatsby, he was who he was, and he did what he did.
George dedicated The Man Who Came Uptown to Charles Wilford and Elmore Leonard. You've probably heard of Leonard, but maybe not Wilford. His work is worth knowing, as George explains.
There was one book in particular called Pickup that is about a couple of alcoholic lovers in San Francisco in the 1950s, in the late 50s. And throughout the book, every time they go into a bar, they go someplace public, other men want to kick this guy's butt, you know, the guy, the male half of the couple. And you're wondering why, you know, what did he do and that kind of thing. So the very last line of the novel is describes him as a tall, lonely Negro walking in the rain. He's black, and you don't know it until the end of the book.
Oh, interesting.
And it forces you to go back and reread the book because everything changes, the meaning of everything changes.
Yes, sir.
In this book, I never identify the race of the protagonist or anyone else.
Yes, that's true.
And
yeah.
Most people have not caught that, and you're really the first person to ask me in an interview about this. It's an homage to him, and the reason I did it was it just always bothered me, myself included, that white writers will always say, and then I saw a black guy on the corner, but they never say, and then I saw a white guy on the corner. You know what I mean?
Yeah, oh, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
And so all I'm trying to do here is see if it works. And so far, nobody's complained. They've figured out who everybody is without me mentioning their color.
Yeah.
And to maybe inch it forward in terms of the discussion of all this.
Yeah. Know. Besides that, this one example, how else has Wilford's fiction influenced your own? Has he influenced it in any other ways?
Well, I think he was known as a crime writer, as I am.
Right.
But he was trying to do something more with the form, and he did. And I'm not comparing myself to him, but that's certainly somebody who I have aspirations of mirroring.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting. Yeah, the Man Who Came Uptown follows the character of Michael Hudson, who finds a love for reading while he is in prison. And you've led these kinds of groups in detention centers for, I think it's 20 years now. Mm-hmm. What have these workshops taught you about the role that books can play for prisoners incarcerated?
Well, it's very important in their in their lives, the ones who are reading. Obviously, not everybody reads when they're locked up, but the guys and the men and women who are reading are really impacted by it positively, of course. And besides the fact that reading for anybody broadens your worldview and takes you places that you can't or don't want to go in your everyday life, it's especially impactful for a prisoner, because when they go into their cell at night, they can escape that cell through reading. You know, their thoughts and their minds go somewhere else, and in effect, they're no longer locked up while they're reading a book.
Yeah, they're enjoying some freedom. Yeah, yeah. Early on in The Man Who Came Uptown, you refer to a book called Behold a Pale Horse by Milton William Cooper. This is one of the most popular books in the American prison system. Can you tell me a bit about it?
Yeah, I would say it's the most popular. It's a book of conspiracy theory. You know, everything from JFK assassination to UFOs.
Yeah.
And it's very popular in prisons, but many jails and prisons outlaw the book. They don't allow it to be part of the library. And they say the reason is because it gets people too jacked up. It makes guys get into arguments, and arguments often lead to other things. I don't know. I'm not going to give any commentary on that. But that's and then the author was actually killed by police.
Yeah.
Which deepens the conspiracy thing, you know?
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Michael Hudson discovers a love for books while in prison. I'm curious, where did you discover your love of books?
Mainly through a teacher at the University of Maryland, Charles Misch. I took an elective class in crime fiction my senior year, and he turned me on to books. And I had never read books like that before. I'd always been forced to read books in high school and so on that didn't speak to my world. You know, when you're given the Scarlet Letter, if you're not that kind of person who's really intellectually curious enough to delve into a book like that, you're going to put it aside, as I did, because I couldn't, you know, like, Scarlet Letter, I don't really care.
Yeah.
Know? But the crime novels were, aside from the crime part of it, which is the least interesting thing for me, they were about working class people, and it's a world that, you know, where I'd grown up. And you know, my dad owned a Greek diner in D.C., and all the people that worked there were working class, and those are people I related to, and my friends and so on. So all of a sudden, I discovered a branch of American literature that was, in my opinion, was populist.
Yeah.
And it got me all stoked, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember, was there one or two books in particular that you can remember reading while you were taking that course at the university?
Yeah, I can tell you the books, but they were, you know, it was Chandler, The Lady in the Lake. I don't know why he chose that one. It's not his best book, but, you know, all of his books are pretty good.
Yeah, that's an interesting film, though, right? You've seen the film version where it's all told from point of view of the detective, yeah.
Yeah, Robert Montgomery.
Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting experiment. I couldn't help notice that you mentioned that crime is the least important part of the books that you just said that about it, books in general. So I'm curious, do you think that applies to your own work? Do you think the crimes that are occurring is the least important part of your fiction?
Well, I try to keep my eye on the reader and make sure that I'm entertaining people with that aspect of the book. So I do a lot of research to make sure that the crime aspect is very realistic. And but for me, what it does is it's a narrative engine. You know, it allows me to tell a story, but what I'm really interested in is the people in those neighborhoods and what their lives are like. And I do want to mention, because you asked me, some of the other books.
Yes.
Red Harvest by Dashiell Hammett.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And one book that really was very influential for me was The Deep Blue Goodbye by John D. MacDonald.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a phenomenal book, just on its own right.
That's not one of the Travis McGee series, though, is it?
It's the first one.
It is the first Travis McGee. Okay.
Yeah. If you have not read it.
I know. I've got to read it because you're speaking highly, and I know Stephen King is often like raved about John D. MacDonald. Yeah, I'm missing out. That's what's missing in my life. I haven't read any John D. MacDonald. Yeah.
It's a long life, man.
Yeah. I don't have that much time left. But, you know, well, especially who knows these days. But, yeah, but thank you for your optimism. All of your books have taken place in your hometown of Washington, D.C. I'm curious about how the D.C. serves as a muse for you, how it inspires your work.
Nobody was really doing it when I started. Nobody was writing about the city, the living city, with people who, you know, have been here for generations and so on. All the books were political, or the Pentagon, and I'm not interested in that at all, but I wanted to read about the town that I knew. And then as I started and got into it a little bit, I sort of figured out what I was going to do with my life, which was chronicle this city, its history, and its present, and by in the end have a whole library of books that, you know, in 100 years, I hope that there are still libraries and people can go into a library and see what D.C. was like in 2018 if they read The Man Who Came Uptown. You know what I mean? So I'm leaving a record, basically.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a great thing to do. The theme of gentrification can be found in your new novel. At one point, Michael Hudson talks about not being able to believe all of the changes. Do you miss the old D.C.?
Yes, I do. When I grew up here, Washington was about 75% black. It's a black city. I mean, to me, it still is. Yeah. Even though it's really 50% now. And all the culture that went with that was very exciting for a young man to grow up in that atmosphere, the music and everything else and the clothing and, you know, the cars. I mean, I'm a guy who still thinks the 70s was the best decade. It was the most exciting decade.
Yeah.
But you have to recognize, you know, you might have to have enough self-recognition to know that a lot of that is nostalgia. And I don't want to fall into that trap because this city is in a lot better shape than it was when I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
The homicide rate is way down. The employment rate is up. There's a lot of jobs. There's a lot of healthy businesses. And, you know, the only thing that I still feel that we need work on is keeping people in the city who work here and producing enough affordable housing so that a lot of different kinds of people can live in the city and not just elites.
Yeah, to have a mix of people from various classes, various backgrounds. Yeah, yeah, that's important to the existence and to making a city interesting, the diversity, yeah. Your characters often have blue-collar or working-class jobs, and in The Man Who Came Uptown, it seems that success is defined by getting a job with health insurance. Is this your take on D.C., the country's working class, and kind of a redefinition of the American dream, that things are so bad that that's like, you know, the gold star, or is just getting health insurance?
I think it's a big piece of the puzzle. I mean, I'm in a union, the Writers Guild of America.
Yeah,
I'm very supportive of unions. Back in the day, when you take a city like Baltimore, which I'm intimately acquainted with, and
of course, yeah,
when there were union jobs, when the factories were up and the docks were thriving and so on, if your kid didn't go to college, which is not all kids should go to college or can. You could get them into the union, and they could have a career with a pension and health insurance, and they could have a middle class life. Those jobs are not readily available anymore.
Yeah,
and it's caused a lot of turmoil in the cities, which we documented on The Wire, season 2 of The Wire. It's very, you know, blatant.
Well, you come by that kind of cash, you know, you ain't had the days.
Oh, definitely not. It's because my father's in the union.
Seniority prevails, Zig. It's the only way to keep it halfway honest.
I know. I ain't complaining.
I wish I could give you more. You don't think I want to throw you more?
Oh, you throw plenty.
It's just, Christ, Zig. Maybe if I'd have listened to your mother, because she's the one always
Pop,
talking about you should do the community college like your brother.
Pop, don't.
Having health insurance, having a pension is a good step towards having a, you know, successful middle-class life, or at least a chance at it.
You've been a writer for many critically acclaimed TV series such as The Wire and Tremé, but your new HBO series, The Deuce, which of course is set in the 70s, which George Pelicanus says is the best decade, The Deuce marks a bit of a career change for you. You're the co-creator along with David Simon. What's the biggest difference being the creator of a TV show?
I mean, you get to make more decisions that impact the way the show comes out. And obviously, you know, you're the boss. So, and I like it. I mean, I like running things in the same way that I liked the control of being a novelist. You know, all these years, it's just been me writing these books. And I wanted to get to that same place in television where I could, my vision could be end up on the screen along with David's, you know, we're partners. So that's been a good thing for me. It's and I'm always, you know, I'm very goal oriented. Obviously, I've done a lot in my career, and I continue to work really hard, and I'm gonna keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, lucky for us, because we're the beneficiaries.
Thank you. You're
probably best known for scripting the penultimate episodes of TV show seasons. In fact, we could even call you penultimate Pelicanos. Hmm. And yet during season one of The Deuce, Megan Abbott had that honor. We had Megan on Beta, our show, a little while ago, and she had this to say about that passing of the baton.
It's a big transition episode. It is the George episode, and he's never let me forget that he let me do it. I don't think it's ever going to happen again.
She's right. She left the show shortly thereafter. So, on her own accord, I should say.
Did she really leave the show?
Yeah, but she left to do her own television show based on the books.
Yeah, Dare Me. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so we didn't want her to leave, okay. By the way. She wrote a great episode.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, she's very talented. Yeah. What is it about your work that had you writing the penultimate episodes of The Wire and Treme?
I think, well, what happened was is the very first thing I wrote for The Wire season one was the episode where Wallace is killed by his friends, and you know, played by the 14-year-old Michael B. Jordan.
You should have stayed down in the country, man.
You boys,
you put this on yourself.
You ain't gotta be like this. Oh,
come on,
that's us, man.
Do it, goddammit, if you're gonna.
People, I don't want to say they liked it because it was a really sad thing to depict on screen, but they thought it was pretty good and well done. And after that, David gave me that episode where consequently a lot of things happened and there's a lot of death and so on. Mm-hmm. The Stringer Bell episode where Brother Muzon and Omar hunt Stringer Bell down and so on. Then when the death of Snoop, I got to write all that stuff. Now, you know, the thing about having your own show is you have to give up some things, too. And I can't always write that episode. And I actually wrote it for this season, that season two that we're in right now. I did write the penultimate episode, so expect carnage.
George Pelicanos is the author of The Man Who Came Uptown. He's also the co-creator and writer of the HBO series The Deuce. You can find out more about George at WPR.org/beta.
And I knew kind of along the way, this is just something that a villain in a John Hughes film would do.
Courtney Hameister joins us to talk about her quest to overcome her chronic anxiety with the OK, Fine, Whatever project. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Courtney Hameister has struggled with anxiety and obsessive-compulsive disorder for a long time. Her OCD is known as harm-focused. People with this condition convince themselves they've done something terrible, even though they haven't. Courtney writes about her mental health struggles in a memoir called Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things. Courtney hosted the syndicated public radio variety show Livewire for several years. But one night in 2013, something happened.
Whenever we would do a show, on the Monday before the show and the writers' meetings, we would have a show on a Saturday. So on that Monday, what I called my dread ball would arrive. And it would be this, about the size of a golf ball, maybe. And then as the week progressed, my dread ball would grow and it would sort of push out my breath, because that's what happens a lot when you have anxieties. You can't take a deep breath and it feels like something's blocking your lungs. And then by the Saturday, I would sort of be inside of the dread ball. Like it was this giant hamster ball I was walking around in, and it really dulls your vision of the world, and it dulls your ability to take in information and to put out information, because you've got this white noise essentially in your brain. And so it was really an unmanageable situation, but it wasn't until this show, it was our 9th anniversary show, that 2 days before I just started having a massive OCD / panic attack. You know, the standard stuff. I was afraid that I was going to hurt my housemate, and I was walking around in sort of constant panic. And I had never not been able to host a show. And I just thought, I still have to do it. And the script was all written. I called my brother and I went over to talk to him. And I had been saying, you know, I have to do this. I have all these people counting on me, the audience, the whole staff of the show. And we have all these stations that we're on.
Yeah.
And my brother is this wonderful, just very straightforward, very kind, but very straightforward person. You know, when you're talking to someone and they kind of tilt your head and they squint at you a little bit and you just know, oh, God. It's coming, right?
Yeah.
And he just gave me this look that really said, it's super adorable that you think you're this important, but it's going to be okay and the world's going to keep turning and you need to call your producer. And so I called our producer, Robin Tenenbaum, and I said, I can't do it. I can't do the show. And weirdly, or I think maybe not weirdly or not coincidentally, we were having Luke Burbank on the show, who hosts a podcast still called TBTL.
Too Beautiful to Live.
Exactly. And we were having him on for the express purpose of seeing if he could back me up, because we didn't have any backup for me if I ever got sick and it was recorded in front of a live audience. And so I called our producer and I said, let's see if Luke will host it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he did. And an amazing and terrible thing happened, and that was that the show was great, and he was great, and it sort of went off, I would say not without a hitch, but it was a good show. He did a great job. And so I realized that this thing that I had helped make, that I loved and I believed I was such a huge part of, could absolutely survive without me. And that was really wonderful, and it was awful.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's tough because you were a big part of it. You'd been doing it for 10 years, and then you continued to work on the show.
Yeah.
Except you just didn't host, but you were writing and producing and supervising writers. And then you came up with the OK, Fine, Whatever project. What was the origin story for the OFW project?
Well, I think that I realized what I had lost. There are myriad reasons why it took me 9 years to leave this thing that was so unhealthy for me. I think that a huge part of it was that these people that I so respected saw me as a peer. And for someone who has massive imposter syndrome, that was a huge help and amazing. And I also was able to meet people like Gus Van Sant and Carrie Brownstein and Mike Birbiglia and Tig Notaro and Maria Bamford, these people that I thought were so incredibly talented. And I got to ask them how they did what they did. And I got to try to get inside their brains. And that to me was this extraordinary gift. And I think that it was so hard for me to leave for all those reasons. And so once I did leave, I realized that I had lost this beautiful thing, this wonderful thing that so few people get the opportunity to do. And I didn't want to lose anything like that again. And I thought, is there a way I can train my brain like you would a child? Like take a child out into the world and say, this is here to hurt you, and this is here for fun. This is here for your edification and to make your life richer, because anxious brains really sometimes have trouble differentiating between those two things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I thought, what if I just did a lot of things that might scare me a little bit, because I'd obviously pushed my boundaries too far by doing Livewire for so long. What if I did smaller things? And then once my brain realized that everything was okay, anxiety turns you into a pessimist.
Yes.
Anxiety just digs these ruts in your neural pathways that are so difficult to get out of. That just say, you think about doing something and your brain immediately goes to, it's not going to work, or here are the 12 terrible things that are going to happen, you know, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is what anxiety does to you. And I didn't think that I would turn into an optimist. I really would have loved to, but I just thought maybe I cannot think that everything's going to be terrible.
So how did you decide which experiences to try, which experiences would make you the most uncomfortable?
Well, that's the thing. I absolutely didn't want things that actually put me in physical peril, because I knew that that was way beyond my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. If my comfort zone was in Oregon, I didn't want to go all the way over to New York. I wanted to be actually maybe around Wisconsin, frankly, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted sort of Wisconsin-y experiences. So it was things that, you know, when you think about an experience, you look at what it feels like in your body when you think about doing it, right?
Yeah.
Do I start to feel a little bit of that buzzing in my chest? A little bit of that buzzing in my chest was fine. I just didn't want something that would actually start to trigger panic, you know, when I just thought about doing it. I knew that was unhealthy.
Yeah, fair enough.
So it was that kind of stuff. I went to a sensory deprivation tank. I went to a professional cuddler. There was a huge dating component of it because I was on this massive dating binge. I did speed dating, which was terrible for me. I mean, it was 18 strangers, and that's the funny thing. It was terrible in its own way, but it was also absolutely fascinating to just get a five-minute window into 18 different people's lives in a matter of, you know, a couple of hours.
Yeah, it's good time management.
Exactly.
So, not including the dating, which I want to get to in a moment, of the other experiences, what was the most, as you would say, relatively dangerous experience that you took that made the biggest difference, that was the most successful in terms of helping you get out of your comfort zone?
Oh, I would say the cuddler for sure. The professional cuddler. I went to Samantha Hess here in Portland, who's gotten a lot of national attention. And it was the one that I approached with the most trepidation, for sure, because I don't want to talk to strangers. So cuddling with a stranger sounded like the third or fourth circle of hell. I don't know where that would land exactly.
I just had this thought that what you could have done, which maybe both you and I would find even more frightening, was you could have done phone cuddling, like cuddle with a stranger and the stranger's on the phone. So
with you.
Yeah, with you.
You're
yeah, they're
on the phone.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Talking to each other in your cell phone. Yeah.
You've just got to order a pizza with
yeah,
them.
Yeah, you have to.
You know? It's like, just get it done. You can do this. But that's the thing. It's like we can order online now. So I feel like that's a skill that we don't need to.
That's right.
Foster. Yeah. But yeah, I think that when people hear professional cuddler, they immediately click into the snark part of their brain. Mm-hmm. And I completely understand why that is. I can understand why people wouldn't trust it. They would think there must be a sexual aspect to it. Because the idea of needing someone like that is so intensely vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that is part of the reason why I was trepidatious about it, was that I have been single for the majority of my adult life, and I felt so much shame around that, and I felt so much shame around how much I needed to be touched. I mean, I used to do breath work mm-hmm. for Livewire to sort of calm me down.
Oh, right, sure.
And I remember lying on the floor with the person that I was working with, and she touched my hand, and she was sort of holding my hand, and I started crying because no one had touched me for so long. I needed touch so much.
Yeah.
And it was sort of the realization, and there's something so poignant about getting the kind of touch that Samantha offers when it's not real, and I know that it's real, right? She's actually sitting there. But when it's not a person in your life that's doing it because they care about you, so you're getting this thing that you need so much, but at the same time, it's this incredible reminder that you're not getting what you want in your life. I think that seeing her made me realize that there's not something wrong with me because I want physical affection and I need it. I'm just human. I'm just a human being.
As you mentioned, the OK Fine Whatever project involved a lot of dating, and you came up with a very creative way to keep track of your dates. Can you tell me about that?
So you want your listeners to hate me?
No, I don't. No, it's not something that makes you worthy of hate. It's interesting. And it's a great insight into your mind. You're kidding.
Yeah. I'm kidding. Yeah. I created a spreadsheet. And it was really because I'm not great at this. And I had done so little of it in my life. I'd had two significant relationships in my life that had really only lasted. One lasted 2 years and one lasted a few months. And I never really dated. There were people that I kind of met through other people. And so I thought, if I approach this scientifically, then my brain's not going to fail me or my heart's not going to be quite as involved. I'm going to be a scientist about this and just kind of look at the facts and the numbers. I had all these categories like my attraction to him, his attraction to me. One of them was loves to talk about ideas, has a job he's passionate about. And I actually, a couple months into it, I put has a car. And you're like, yeah. I think you got 1 point for a car and 0 points for not a car. Great conversation was one. And so I rated people from 1 to 10. I'm so sorry, but I did in all of these categories. But, you know, as a person who's probably dated people, there are some categories that count significantly more than other categories.
Oh, yeah.
Like, has a car is a million times less important than great conversation.
Yeah.
You know, easy conversation or loves to talk about ideas or whatever. This is for me, right?
Right. For someone who lives in Los Angeles, having a car might be among the most important things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, having a job at a studio that I can take advantage of is also somewhere on that list, probably.
Exactly. So you dated many men. Did you ever find true love?
In the book, I just sort of refer to the guys oftentimes as a number because I had 28 first dates that year.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I just kind of, this was first date number 7 and then sort of what ended up happening with him. And I went on maybe over a little over 100 dates for the whole year because I would have ensuing dates with some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine wrote me on Facebook and said, oh, my gosh, I just finished the book and I really enjoyed it. And also, it's a love story.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of it. But, yeah, I did end up falling in love with someone. That's the thing. You know, I wanted to be clear with this friend. I said, but just to be clear, me falling in love with someone was not sort of the happy ending of the book. Because, as we all know, falling in love with someone is not a happy ending. It's the beginning of, you know, and especially in a book that's sort of about trying to figure out your stuff. And since I've been in so few relationships, this really helped me realize, oh, now I have someone that I love and I'm an anxious person. That means I have got to figure out not how to fix all of this stuff about me that drives me crazy, how to change the way that I think about those things, because I will drive myself crazy thinking that I have all of these things that are broken about me, and these are all the reasons he's going to fall out of love with me. That's where you really start doing the work, not in making yourself lovable, but in recognizing that you are lovable as a broken person and that you're working on it and you're human. That's really where the work begins. As everyone knows, you know, who's been in a lot of relationships, but I hadn't. So I was learning that like a freaking high schooler, you know.
Yeah. Did this guy score high on the spreadsheet, or were you not using the spreadsheet anymore at that point?
You know, I was, because I used it all year. And that's the thing. It's like, and that was part of the reason why I recognized. And I knew kind of along the way, this is just something that a villain in a John Hughes film would do. This isn't great, but it's not until someone that you truly care about is on the spreadsheet and you're looking at the numbers that you assigned to him when you first met him that you really feel like a jerk. And he was on there and he scored very high, but he wasn't the number one one.
No.
But this is the thing. Anybody scores high on a spreadsheet if you don't know anything about them. You know?
Yeah,
like,
good point.
Yeah, if someone presents themselves to you, I think that the guy who scored the highest was a guy that I never saw again. He was this guy that his job was to climb the largest trees in Oregon and measure them.
Lumberjack guy.
Lumberjack guy. Exactly. The fact that I gave him the highest score was the dumbest thing in the world because it had to do with his job. He was fun to talk to and fascinating. But when I thought about it, it was like, I am not outdoorsy in the least. And his photos on OkCupid were him at the top of trees. And one of the photos was him attached with carabiners to the side of a cliff because he was camping that night off the side of a cliff.
Wow.
My worst nightmare was his vacation. Of course we weren't compatible. No. So this spreadsheet idea was completely broken. But he did score very high.
Mm-hmm. For those of our listeners who may find themselves struggling with these kind of issues, with anxiety mm-hmm. and OCD, what advice would you give them?
I believed that sort of becoming more adventurous and it's not going to kill you was sort of a muscle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I found that the more that I did it, the more comfortable that I got doing it. And that's a lot to ask somebody who's anxious, but I would say that that worked for me. But also at the same time, I was going to someone, and not really at the same time, it was toward the end, I started going to a therapist who really started to teach me mindfulness. And what I would say is I find breathing magical. So get an app, something like the Calm app. The Calm app has this very simple, just part of the app that all it is just this little circle and it just shows you to breathe. And you just watch it, and it just, you breathe in when it shows you to breathe in, and you breathe out when it shows you to breathe out. And people say, don't tell me to breathe. It's, you know, they think it's woo-woo.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not. It's science. When you breathe deeply into your diaphragm and you, and those muscles push out in your belly, there are chemicals that are released that tell your brain that everything's okay. So I would say that. I would say breathe. And mindfulness, the reason that we are anxious is that we are freaked out and full of shame about past mistakes that we made that we can't let go of, and we are terrified of the future. We are living in the past and the future, and it is driving us crazy, literally. And what mindfulness does is it forces you to just be in the present moment and look at what is in front of me right now, and can I deal with that?
Somewhere in between.
Courtney Hameister is the author of Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things. You can find out more about Courtney's story at WPR.org/beta.
The thing that satisfies me most as a unified theory is just the idea that there's an evolutionary reason, maybe, for comedy, that our primate ancestors needed to find it pleasurable when they found some little absurdity or incongruity in life, and then they solved the problem.
Up next, Jeopardy! Champion Ken Jennings explains how comedy conquered our culture. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Everyone thinks they're a comedian these days. They're always making jokes and cracking sarcastic comments. At least, that's what Ken Jennings thinks. He's the author of Planet Funny: How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. You might remember Ken from Jeopardy. He's the 74-time champion. Ken says that these days, everybody wants to be funny. But why?
I think just because it's so hard to back out of. You know, once somebody has decided to be funny, anybody else who comes back kind of earnest and heartfelt, or even worse, solemn and humorless, just seems stodgy and out of touch by comparison. So humor is a ratchet in a culture that only works one way. Things can get more funny all the time, and then they seem fun and edgy and youthful and transgressive, but you can never wind it back. So what we're seeing now is that ratchet increasing in almost every area of public life.
Yeah, so it has to keep evolving and amping up, and there's no turning back. We're not going to get less funny. We have to become more funny. You say that our gradual descent into this nonstop comedy culture started in the early decades of the 20th century, and you blame it all on one man. Who?
There's a Russian futurist poet. The futurists were in love with the modernity of the new century, and there was going to be new technology and trains and radio. And there was a Russian named Velimir Klebnikov who was in love with all this, and he considered himself a bit of a seer. He actually predicted the internet. He predicted the Leninist revolution in Russia. And he wrote a poem called Invocation of Laughter, which is kind of a celebration of laughter above all. And to me, it predicts the next century of human civilization very well.
Could you read this poem for us?
Yeah, it's short. O laugh, laughers, O laugh out, laughers, you who laugh with laughs, you who laugh it up laughishly, O laugh out laugheringly, O be laughable laughterhood, the laughter of laughering laughers, O unlaugh it out laughingly, be laughering laughists, laughily lappily, up laugh, end laugh, laughlings, laughlings, laughlets, laughlets, O laugh, laughers, O laugh out, laughers.
So how exactly does this Russian poem from 109 years ago predict our current comedy culture?
Well, I like how it's just a series of kind of invented words and riffs on the word laugh. You know, in Russian as in English, laughlings and laughterhood and be laughable, these are not words.
Right.
But it really reminds me of how our idea of what a joke is and how it can be structured has just mutated endlessly like a fractal or a snowflake in the 20th and now in the 21st century. Because as you say, it's got to evolve. It's got to be something new that maybe our ancestors or even our parents wouldn't even have recognized as a joke.
Sure. So talk a bit about this mutation. Play this out for me. How have jokes mutated? How have they changed over the last century or last 100 years or so?
I don't think it's just tastes shifting or things going back and forth, you know, like airline jokes coming into vogue and then out. It's not just fads like that. I really do feel like there's an evolution where jokes have gotten more complex, more sophisticated, and weirdly kind of more vague and harder to point to. I think for centuries, jokes were explicable, basically. You know, you could explain a joke or a one-liner with a simple one-line explanation if the person doesn't get the joke. You could say, oh, he was referring to a drink called a grasshopper, not the grasshopper who walked into the bar.
Yeah.
And nobody would laugh, but people would be like, oh, okay, right. And today, the comic sensibility is really a lot more elusive. It's really just saying something so off the wall that people kind of give a sharp, barking laugh of absurdity, like, whoa, the punchline of that joke is to mention cranberry bogs. I've never really thought of cranberry bogs as a funny thing, but, well, there it is on Family Guy. I guess it's a joke now.
Yeah, exactly. And you talk about Neil Postman's 1985 book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And in this book, Postman expressed concern that mass media was going to be the death knell for American culture. Do you see a connection between Postman's prediction and our contemporary comedy-centric culture?
I do. You know, he was talking about news getting lighter and goofier and celebrity culture taking over, you know, things that were light and frivolous bleeding into things that he thought should be serious. He doesn't really call out comedy per se. But what I've noticed about our era is all the stuff he was worried about, all the technological frivolousness that's going to distract us from affairs of real import. Increasingly, we've chosen to anesthetize ourselves with comedy. That's what makes us feel good. Often the endless stream of content on our phone is jokes. You know, a lot of the backlog of stuff I feel like I have to see on Netflix are stand-up specials. There's just more of this than we can ever possibly watch. You know, we spend our lives looking at a stream of jokes and slightly amusing cat videos on our phones.
Yeah, exactly. So talking about the internet, how much of a part has the internet, and in particular Twitter, played in comedy's conquest of our culture?
Twitter was why I particularly wrote the book. I'm sure other people have their own comedy Achilles heels or kryptonite or whatever you call the thing that ruins your life. But for me, it was definitely Twitter. You know, at first it was such a joy that all these funny people, not just famous comedians and comedy writers, but just kind of random civilians from all over the world, were riffing and joking together on the affairs of the day. And as soon as something goofy happened, a raccoon would climb a building in Toronto and you'd immediately see 500 jokes about it. You wouldn't have to wait for Jimmy Fallon or the Weekend Update people to write jokes. What a blessing to have all that in my pocket.
So follow up on that comment you made about Twitter ruining your life. How has it ruined your life? That because you're trying to make jokes all the time on Twitter? Tell me about that.
That's part of it. I mean, part of it is it turns us all into comedians. We're no longer an audience out there with our drinks, you know, laughing in the darkness. We're all like, ooh, I got to get in here. What can I say? You know, so you have that little white rectangle in Twitter that wants you to just make a joke, be funny like these people. And that's not good for your brain to always be the guy who's trying to think of a joke. It's also not good for your relationships, I think. It's not good spiritually.
Mm.
But also just the fact that I had this machine in my pocket that could just give me this endless stream of amusement anytime I looked on it. I found it very addictive. The brain doesn't have a satiety signal for internet content the way it does for food or sex or even heroin. You know, like, that's something you can get addicted to and your brain will just never get enough. It wants you to just keep checking your phone for new jokes until you die.
You probably don't experience this much because you're quite funny, but there's the frustration if you have a joke that you post on Twitter that you think is great and then you hear crickets.
That happens to me all the time. And sometimes, you know, that's not the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is saying you thought was sort of snarky and offhand and then realizing that what you had written down was far more, you know, offensive or wrong or transgressive in some way than you ever meant. And then you just look like an idiot. There's a world full of bajillions of jokes and you added the wrong one completely unnecessarily. That can ruin your day.
Can you give me an example of a joke you made that ruined your day because you didn't see the implications?
On Twitter, it can be anything. You know, I remember making a joke once about, I think, beehives and colony collapse disorder, and I had a beekeeper tell me very sternly that was not helping the cause. You know, the thing about the internet is there's a subculture for everything. So if you make a slightly irreverent joke about Star Wars fans, you will immediately hear from 100 angry Star Wars fans who amplify it to thousands of others, and then it turns into a thing.
Sure. Okay, well, let's flip it around. What is the best Twitter joke that you've made, the one you're most proud of? Can you point to one?
I wish there was a single thing I've said on Twitter that I didn't feel kind of vaguely ashamed of afterwards. Like, that's kind of the effect of social media.
But there must be one that you're less ashamed of.
At first, when it was 140 characters, you could really do a nice, tight one-liner. And, you know, you would feel good if you really nailed something. Like I remember saying one time, how do they get the hurricanes to arrive in alphabetical order? To me, it's a mildly funny observation that switches up cause and effect. But, you know, I felt like a king. I told a funny joke on Twitter.
There was this recent incident involving this social media comedian, Darren Knight, at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal. And
yes,
he was booed off stage after insulting his fellow comedians, the audience, and the festival. It's proof, isn't it, that just because you're funny online, it doesn't mean you're going to be funny on stage.
That's exactly right. And it means you have to tailor your audience to the room. You know, his hilarious Southern mama material did not play in a room of hardened comedians and comedy fans in Montreal.
Surprise.
We're all kind of increasingly comedy geeks. I think he didn't account for the fact that the mainstream comedy audience is now an obsessed and geekish one who is very aware of what all the current fault lines and discussions are and the current level of policing of different topics. I'm not against this new woker audience, honestly. I think it's great that instead of giving comedians a pass and being like, well, he said something awful, but he's a comedian. It's just Roseanne being Roseanne. I like the idea that we're actually able to grapple with these things now and say, well, hold on, like, what are the effects of that joke? Why wouldn't you flip the joke around so it actually took on someone in a powerful position instead of a weaker one, or, you know, any of these endless discussions that we have about jokes today. I think that's great that we're thinking more seriously, because if the humor is going to be a dominant force in our culture, we can't just give everybody a hall pass to make whatever awful jokes they want.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's been a lot of research into humor and what makes us laugh over the last several years. Is there anyone who you think has come close to creating a grand unified theory of jokes?
One thing I really wanted in my book was, what's the grand unified theory? Because nobody's sure. You know, Aristotle and Socrates thought jokes were for ridicule, and Freud thought it was to blow off steam about taboo sexual topics, predictably, because he's Freud. And Kant thought it was all incongruity. You know, some expectation gets deflated, and then you laugh. You know, the thing that satisfies me most as a unified theory is just the idea that there's an evolutionary reason, maybe, for comedy, that our primate ancestors needed to find it pleasurable when they found some little absurdity or incongruity in life, and then they solved the problem. Mm. They thought, oh, I see why I tried to stab the fish, but I missed, or I tripped over the vine in the path, you know?
Yeah.
The cavemen who didn't find that pleasurable to make those little discoveries immediately died out, all by tripping over vines.
Yeah.
But the ones who could laugh at it lived to fish another day. So comedy may have been how we became human.
Sure, part of the survival of the fittest, a good sense of humor. You talk about a joke that a young Woody Allen told in a Washington, D.C. nightclub in 1965. Can you tell me a bit about the joke and what you find so amazing about it?
Well, I mean, I guess it's problematic to use Woody Allen as your example for
yeah,
anything,
right? I wondered about that, but I figured, what the heck, because it was a very good point you made, I thought.
You know, as I was writing the book, I kept having to modify different parts of the book as different comedians fell into disrepute, you know, like, oh, let's search and replace for Cosby. The Woody Allen story, it's on one of his very first records, and he's talking to a club audience, and he says,
I must pause for one fast second and say a fast word about oral contraception. I was involved in an extremely good example of oral contraception 2 weeks ago. I asked a girl to go to bed with me, and she said no.
And there's this long pause in the room while people wait to hear why she said no. And suddenly people realize, oh, oral contraception. Oh, I get it. That's the. And so, like, seconds later, there's this huge laugh. And the funny part of that story to me is how we've evolved as an audience. Today, it would not take a savvy comedy club audience a long 5 second silence to get that joke. We would probably have heard similar jokes, you know, like, people calling thick glasses birth control glasses, for example. It's a comedy yeah. trope we're all familiar with. And we all know how jokes are constructed now, and Woody would not have surprised us
yeah.
today. It's evidence that comedy doesn't just change. It really does evolve like a species.
As you point out, protest signs, historically, they haven't been a real hotbed of comedy. But that has been changing recently, hasn't it?
That's one of the most interesting things I found, and it's related to this idea that comedy is becoming woke and political, and we want to make sure that it does good in the world and not just diverts people. And yeah, you go to any kind of demonstration or protest march today, no matter what the issue is, and you'll find people really like workshopping jokes on their signs. You know, anti-Trump posters will say, "We shall overcome," you know, whereas 50 years ago, the civil rights marchers would have said, "We shall overcome." You know, people, part of it is wanting to go viral, but I think part of it is really, this is how you communicate in our culture now. You convince people by making them laugh.
Exactly. As you write in the book, social protest is borrowing the language of comedy because comedy is quickly absorbing the concerns of social protest.
Watching Hannah Gadsby do Nanette and say things that are not funny at all about sexual abuse and homophobia and rape and assault, people have realized they can use this comedy monologue form to make people laugh, but at the same time, to be activists, to be convincing about an agenda that maybe people need some convincing on. Because when it's in a comedy routine, you let down your guard.
Mm-hmm. What do we gain and what do we lose when our culture is all comedy all the time?
Well, I mean, we've seen some of the dangers. You know, politics used to be a no comedy zone. Abraham Lincoln was a funny guy, but he refused to tell jokes in debates or on the stump because he thought these were serious times. The people deserved a serious president. And that all went out the window in 1992 when Bill Clinton ran for president. And he was going to be the guy playing the sax with Arsenio and hanging out with Larry King and Phil Donahue. And everyone at the time tut-tutted about how this was the end of civilization. But young people loved it. Look, he's accessible. He's approachable. He's our generation. He's joking around. And it's landed us where we are today, you know, in a world where a generation gets their news from comedy shows. And it's very easy for a certain kind of showman to win political office ahead of more qualified people because we expect the day's events to be entertaining above all.
Yeah.
So I think there are dangers and downsides. And the problem is, I don't know what to do. I love comedy. You know, the book is a love letter, I think, to comedy. I've loved it my whole life.
What is good about this all-comedy culture in which we live?
You know, I like that it's leveled the playing field. You know, the technology aspect has really let funny people that you wouldn't expect have a platform. You know, now it's no longer just the same 30 white men who were on the Lampoon together at Harvard. Our new technology really does allow people to have a voice. And satire has a certain power. A satirist can use exaggeration and hyperbole. It can like lull a suspicious audience into listening to a topic, a tricky topic about race or feminism or class or whatever it is that they might be a little bit ginger about. So comedy's great that way. And it feels so good. It's a hard world, you know? We need a laugh at the end of the day.
Ken Jennings is the author of Planet Funny: How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. I'll take show endings for 600, Alex.
The other daily level.
Binge on past episodes by subscribing to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Steve.
What is the Sphinx?
Yes.
Could I have singers in the films?
Whoop. Hang on.
What is the Sphinx?
I thought that's what he said.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Great performance by Adam, the giant killer.
And thanks to you, our alphas.
If you guys ring in and get this one, I will die.
Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Doug, I have to say, it has been a pleasure.